This week on The Score, what happens when candidates for Commonwealth Attorney face off? Why does Ukraine loom so large in foreign affairs? Can we ever be satisfied by the Electoral College? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. This was a big week in politics, no matter what your perspective. Two candidates for Commonwealth's attorney in Albemarle County debated each other, and we chatted with each of them afterwards. Stay tuned for the second half of The Score to hear what they have to say about the law and about each other. But first, let's look at a name that's in the headlines this week and looks to stay there for a long time to come. Ukraine, the Eastern European country that may determine the future of who lives in the White House. A few months ago, we spoke with John Dale Grover, assistant managing editor of The National Interest, in anticipation of Ukraine's presidential election. He's back with us this week to talk about how Ukraine fits into the international political and economic order. I spoke with him by telephone on Thursday from his office in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us on The Score today. The name of the country, Ukraine, has been in the news a lot lately. I don't really want to talk about what's in the news. I'd like to get some background from a foreign policy perspective about the role that Ukraine plays in U.S. foreign policy and how it fits in terms of Europe and Russia. Let's just get some background, maybe going back to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Is that a good place to start, or do you think it would be better to go back even further?
We can start there. I would say that Ukraine has certainly had a long and troubled history. When they found themselves free of the control of the communists after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they had a lot of work to do. Like Russia, they inherited a top-heavy economy. They had an oligarchic system, which they still have. A lot of questions about how you're going to pull off economic and political reform. And this led to different revolutions along the way. So there was the Orange Revolution and various protest movements because people were generally happy. And this is the same kind of stuff that led up to the Maidan protests that led to all the crisis and everything we have now and Moscow's reaction, which is essentially that people wanted democracy, but just as much, if not more so, they wanted a good economic shake, right? They wanted a chance to have a better life, to improve themselves, and they were very sick of all the corruption that they saw.
We're talking with John Dale Grover from the National Interest about Ukraine, and we've talked about Ukraine in the past in the run-up to the election that brought Volodymyr Zelensky to power, or at least to office. But let's talk a bit about how successful or unsuccessful Ukrainian democracy has been in the past 25 years. After the Soviet Union collapsed, they needed to write a new constitution, elect honest politicians. What happened? Did they do a good job at the beginning, or did it take a while?
I'd say it take a while. I'd even say, unfortunately, it's quite the work in progress. And to the extent that if it weren't for the unusual circumstances of the conflict that's been raging in eastern Ukraine, I would say that they would not be ready for admission to the European Union or to NATO just by the criteria that both of those organizations have set. Now, granted, Ukraine is very important politically. The West is very sympathetic to their cause, so there's a decent chance that they would be fast-tracked into either organization, but there's limits to how far you can go with that. And they've just had a long time of struggle with the corruption and everything. So, you know, you have someone who comes in who looks like they were former, and then doesn't work out very well, and then you have someone else, and then it's just kind of this rotating door of these different oligarchs, or different political figures, and they haven't really been able to make it all work. Now, that being said, things have drastically, improved. They've got a lot of assistance from the West, from, of course, NATO and the European Union, but from various, philanthropies and different think tanks who are trying to help them build the foundations of democracy. And I think that the election of Zelensky, was by all accounts for them, fair and free, and this isn't a good step forward for them.
On a superficial level, the fact that, political power has switched from one party to another, from different political figures at the top to another, that has a superficial resemblance to a competitive political system, and people might stand by and say, hey, Ukraine's doing a good job. But you seem to think that revolving door government is more of an illness than a sign of health. Is that right?
Well, it depends on which ones, but yes, certainly. I mean, again, that's the reason why so many people went with Zelensky, even though he was an unknown. I mean, he was a comedian, and that was what he was known for before, as an actor in a TV show. Ironically enough, a show that was about an outsider who accidentally became Ukrainian president. So I guess he decided to go for it in real life. And people went with him because he was different, and he wasn't the same old. He was a fresh new face. It was a huge chance that, you know, not a lot of details as to what he might try to do other than fight corruption and try to bring peace to the country. And that's what he's what he's working on now. They've announced that they might have some kind of agreement based on the Steinmeier formula. This is something that the Germans, they came up with as a peace plan. Of course, the details are not released yet, right? So it looks like, oh, maybe they have something here, but until we see more, it's kind of hard to see if this is going to lead anywhere. They've tried that before with Minsk II, and that didn't work out.
Let's talk a bit about Ukraine's economy. During the Soviet era, it was known as the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. And it, I guess topographically, it bears a great resemblance to the Great Plains of Canada and the United States. And that may be why so many Ukrainians end up in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. But what does Ukraine have to offer economically? And let's suppose for a moment that it's not involved in a war with the Russians. But if it were a peaceful country, what would it be producing that the world would want to buy?
Certainly. Well, there are natural resources that they do have around Crimea. So there's different kinds of fossil fuels that they would have access to. And more importantly, this is the fact that there's that's a warm port that is very helpful, which is why the Russians are so keen on having it. And as you did mention, there are a fair amount of agricultural exports, and they've been working hard to try to build up their industrial capacity as well. And this is something that they've been doing more of, especially because of the war. So trying to import different things, weapons, different kinds of supplies, but also trying to improve that capacity. And I'd say one thing that's kind of the flip side of being new and independent since the collapse of the Soviet Union, trying to figure everything out, is that, well, yes, that's a huge burden. It's also a huge opportunity. So if you look at the way Estonia was able to turn everything around and become a huge tech powerhouse, a huge startup center, there's no reason why, under the correct conditions, through certain kinds of reforms, that Ukraine couldn't make itself into a very competitive economic country if it so desired.
On paper, is Ukraine's economy a free market economy? Does it have laws on the books that protect the rule of law, property rights, the ability to start a business, or is it still in the startup phases of crony capitalism and socialist undertones?
Quite a bit of crony capitalism, hence the problem with the oligarchs and a lot of the protests that happened, both with the Maidan and again with the Orange Revolution. But I would say they've still come a long way and are much better than what they used to. I mean, if you compare to how they could have ended up, say, look at Belarus, another former SSR, they're still very Stalinist. I mean, in some ways, they're one of the last very harsh, top-down economic systems in the world. And thankfully, they've been able to shake that off. And again, not the best way to do it is by becoming corporatists and having all these oligarchs, but that's still better than not. And as I mentioned, they're coming along. Because again, they want to be a part of the European Union. They want to be a part of NATO. And both of those organizations require that they meet certain economic and political criteria. So that means being a vibrant democracy. That means protecting diversity rights. That means having the protection of property rights and the rule of law kind of things that you would need to actually have a good capitalist economy.
As Ukraine looks out towards the world, it's kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. It wants to be more orientated towards the West, towards the European Union, but Russia wants to maintain a grip on it. And how can a successful Ukrainian government, foreign policy establishment, deal with walking that tightrope?
Well, I think the harsh truth is that they're going to have to go a middle route. They're going to have to do something like Finland has done, and establish themselves as enough of a porcupine that Russia will never be able to dominate them. And they've come a long way in forming their military. It's much more formidable now. It's more professional. Again, a lot of that is due Western help, but, credit where credit's due, the Ukrainians are fighting for their country. And so there's that aspect to it, just having, a lot of draftees, a lot of people who are just able to fight and make themselves, again, scary enough. But the other part of that, unfortunately, means giving up on the dream of joining the European Union or NATO. Russia will never allow that. Russia is bigger and badder. They're the spoiler actor in this situation. If Russia says no, then they can't do that because Russia would no doubt use an even harsher degree of force in order to prevent it from happening. It's the same kind of thing you saw in Georgia. Georgia had a lot of aspirations to join Western institutions, but Russia went in and stopped that by supporting two different separatist areas, and they keep those separatist areas as a sore spot to just remind them who's in control. It's the same thing you see now in Ukraine playing out all over again. So that's the problem. I don't know if they can do that, but because it's a very harsh thing to do, but they'd have to give up on that and say, we're going to have to be neutral. But we can make ourselves tough enough that Russia will never, ever really keep us down.
Just to add a little bit of nuance to this, it may have been you who told me this, but there seems to be a motivation by Vladimir Putin, the president for life in Russia, that he does not want to see a successful liberal democracy right next door because it would put too much pressure on his country to become a successful liberal democracy. So he wants to undermine Ukraine's success. Is that an accurate reading?
I think so. I think that's less important to him than if Ukraine, which was traditionally a subjugated part of Russia going even back to the 1700s, if it joined Western institutions. That, I think, is more concerning to Putin than whether or not Ukraine becomes a vibrant democracy. But I think there's truth to that. He does not want an example that's right next door. It's the same kind of thing you see with China being worried about the protests in Hong Kong or about the success of Taiwan. Either of those are reminders that a culturally similar group can, in fact, pull off democracy. And that's something that's always worried some dictators.
We could go on and on about this. I was about to ask a question about how the Soviets suppressed the Catholic Church in Ukraine and replaced it with the Orthodox Church, and how that is part of the East-West division. But we've got to stop now. We're running out of time. John Dale Grover, thank you again for joining us on The Score. You've been a guest before, and I hope to have you as a guest again sometime.
Thank you. I appreciate being invited.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Another issue that people like to talk about these days is the Electoral College. Is it a flawed system for electing the president? Professor Mark Rush of Washington and Lee University has thought about this a lot. I called him on Thursday to learn more about the Electoral College. He was in his faculty office in Lexington. Mark Rush, you recently published an article about the Electoral College, which is a topic of some dispute in the country right now. Essentially, what you said is that nobody's ever going to be satisfied by the Electoral College. And so what brought you to that conclusion?
Well, I read had numerous pieces really since the election of President Trump back in 2016, protesting or complaining or criticizing about the function of the Electoral College because it has the capacity to declare the winner of the presidency someone who has not received a majority of the popular vote. This also happened in the election of 2000. Various and sundry critics suggested that this was undemocratic, potentially unconstitutional, a travesty of justice, and so forth. And the purpose I had in writing the article was to point out that, well, no system of electing anybody is perfect. This really is a product of the manner in which we allocate seats in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And so it has built into it certain, if you will, quote, undemocratic, unquote, tendencies because it deviates from straight majority rule. But that's what the founders intended. And it's also not uncommon across the world to see similar formula, not necessarily for electing presidents, but for allocating power in national legislatures. And I just thought that it was important to put the American debate into sort of a broader global context.
What do you know about the origins of the Electoral College? My understanding is that it was a sort of a last-minute compromise by the members of the Constitutional Convention because they wanted to get out of Philadelphia and they had not yet decided how to elect the president. Is that true or is that something of a myth?
You know, I've read different accounts. I think had there been better air conditioning in Philadelphia at the time, maybe we'd have a better explanation of the Electoral College. That's true. But the Electoral College manifests both a compromise among big and little states. Small states would have feared a popular election or a president because even back then they worried about the biggest states, in that case New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, really dominating the process. And it was also an opportunity for the states themselves to retain a certain corporate presence in the Electoral College, because if you do recall, the Constitution was elected on a state-by-state basis by the people. The Constitution was ratified on a state-by-state basis by the people, resident in each state. But the states did want to retain a certain amount of the power they had under the Articles of Confederation. And so the Electoral College provided a way to combine both sort of a direct democratic appeal as well as a corporate state appeal in electing the president.
What are the alternatives to the Electoral College? And, well, let me put it this way. What were the alternatives that they were considering then that might still be relevant today? I suppose one would be the direct election of the president by all the voters. Another would be for Congress to elect the president, like the British Parliament elects a prime minister. Were there any other alternatives in the air? And are there other alternatives, as you say, globally in other countries that might be a consideration today?
Well, those really are the alternatives that I'm aware of. This is one of the points I wanted to emphasize in the piece, is that this really gets down to what I like to call constitutional math. There's only so many methods by which you can assemble votes and choose something. In this case, as you know, yes, the election of a president, that's not uncommon. That would solve a lot of problems. There's also elections, say, by the national legislature. That's what they do essentially with a parliament and a prime minister. Or, you know, that's how we choose the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. It's done within the legislatures. We wouldn't do that here because we do have the separation of powers, and that would really essentially be a violation of, you know, that aspect of the founding principles of the constitutional order. Direct election would work. Again, especially today, there's no reason not to have it, except, frankly, the Electoral College is enshrined in the Constitution, and in order to get rid of it, you would have to literally amend the Constitution. So that's a pretty hefty challenge. It's very difficult to amend the Constitution with good reason. And so we need to fall back and say, well, what are the real flaws of the Electoral College, besides the fact that it tends occasionally, and unfortunately twice very recently, to generate essentially a minority winner?
And I think one of the major objections to the Electoral College as it exists today is the winner-take-all aspect that all but two states use. And that's not constitutionally mandated. Every state can choose how its electors are allocated and how they are selected. Do you see any solution in that area of the states choosing a different way to select their electors?
You know, that's perhaps the most obvious and, frankly, I think simplest and most effective alternative that we have right now. The states are free to choose the manner in which they allocate their electoral votes. And as you say, only a couple of states have deviated from winner-take-all. There is no constitutional reason to do that. But again, it's a question of, you know, convincing states whose legislators and representatives in Congress are essentially elected by that same winner-take-all system to deviate from it. And I think that would also create a precedent, because then there would be tremendous pressure, I think, to elect members of Congress and members of the state legislature by a similarly fairer, I think, when proportional representation system.
Yeah, it's interesting that Maine, one of the two states that chooses its electors by congressional district, has also adopted a form of proportional representation through the single transferable vote, I think it is.
Yes. You know, and I really do think that that is, that's the future. That is a big debate that this country has to confront. Elections by winner-take-all rules really do minimize the quality and quantity of choices voters have. They still, you know, tend to discriminate against smaller either ethnic or political minority groups. They discourage competition in elections because incumbents tend to dominate them and so forth. But the problem is that virtually every elected official in the country has been elected by a system of winner-take-all, and they do fear the unknown. Nonetheless, I think you will see, as we move forward, increasing pressures for electoral reform, and it wouldn't surprise me if we began to see some litigation trying to mandate it.
When you talk about the Electoral College with your students, what kind of comments do they make? Because, you know, they're new voters. They're just coming into the political system. What do they say about it when you have discussions on this topic in class?
Well, some shake their heads and just simply say, this is silly. Why can't we just elect the president directly? And they understand, of course, that the constitutional, you know, amendment process stands in the way. They also shake their heads a little bit when I try to explain to them the mathematics that underlies the allocation of power within the Electoral College, because that really boils down to the formula by which we apportion House seats among the states. And so they do come to appreciate, at least, that this is a complex matter. You are trying to assign and allocate political power among entities of radically different populations and sizes, and trying to combine those powers in a way that generates an acceptably democratic outcome. And then, you know, what I will do is cast this in comparative perspective, which is what I do in the article. I show them that the Electoral College is simply a manifestation of federalism. And if you look around the world, there's lots of federal countries. Canada, the United States, Germany, Spain, the entire European Union is federal. And they allocate seats among their constituent states or provinces or whatnot by various and sundry formula, which never allocate power exactly on an equal basis in terms of population. Federal nations do tend to give smaller entities, smaller minority states, whatever you want to call them, disproportionate power per capita, but normally that doesn't make too much difference, because the biggest states or provinces, whether they're California or Ontario and Quebec or whatnot, do tend to dominate national politics. Nonetheless, again, the formulas vary from country to country, but this is really it's a symptom of federalism. It's not a symptom of failed democracy. On another note, too, I point out to them, too, that if you want to think about it, the United Nations is perhaps a terribly good example of how allocation formula can really go awry. All the nations in the United Nations have one vote each, regardless of population. Folks do protest that from time to time. But what this manifests then is an appreciation for democracy, but a corresponding appreciation for a concern that really animated our founders, which is, you know, taking care of minority rights and not letting majorities or the largest political entities just run roughshod over minorities.
One thought came to mind as you were discussing how the Electoral College members, the electors, aligns with the number of members of Congress. And it reminded me that the House of Representatives has not grown by a single member since 1912. We have the same number, 435 voting members of Congress today that we had over 100 years ago, despite the fact that the country is more than twice as big population-wise.
Yes, I mean, some folks have suggested that we're long past due for an increase in the size of the House of Representatives. Our electoral districts, our congressional districts are very big, more than 500,000 voters per district. And critics argue that really it's very difficult to conceive of a truly representational relationship between, you know, one member of Congress and his or her 500,000 constituents. The problem is we would need to think about how much bigger the House would be, and that would introduce no small amount of politicking in the Congress, because the next, you know, the allocation formula for power is already set in stone, and you can predict who would actually get the next seats. And so partisan politics will come into play. If more of those seats are going to go to democratically dominated or Republican dominated states, there'd be a tremendous amount of politicking. And don't think for one minute that folks haven't already projected who would get those next seats and what the impact would be. So that certainly remains a possibility. We could certainly do that with very little trouble, but again, politics gets in the way.
Absolutely. Well, we could go on talking about this all day, I think, and it would be fascinating to sit in on one of your classes where this is a topic of discussion. But Mark Rush, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate your time today, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Thanks so much.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at beringdrift.com.
This past Wednesday in Charlottesville, the senior statesmen of Virginia hosted a candidates forum. The first half featured two candidates for Commonwealth Attorney in Albemarle County. Incumbent Republican Robert Tracy faces a challenge from criminal defense lawyer Jim Hingley. I spoke to them both after the debate. First, here's Robert Tracy, who was elected in 2015. Robert Tracy, you're a candidate for re-election for Commonwealth Attorney in Albemarle County, and you just got off the debate stage, senior statesman of Virginia. How do you think the debate went?
I thought it was very revealing that my opponent openly embraced his approach to political prosecution, saying that there's no difference between applying the law and being a social justice warrior. It was alarming that he would say so, but positive that he's educating the public about what his agenda would be if he were elected to a position that he's unqualified to serve in. He also said that he would indict cases to see what criminal activity occurred, and that's inconsistent with the oath of office and also inconsistent with the rules of professional responsibilities of a prosecutor to bring cases when they're supported by probable cause or more.
Some of our listeners are probably first-time voters, so they might want to know, what is the Commonwealth Attorney? What do you do?
The Commonwealth Attorney is established in the Virginia Constitution, and his or her authorities are delineated in the Virginia Code. He is part of the law. He or she, I'm sorry, is part of the law enforcement community in the jurisdiction in which he or she is elected, and has the obligation to bring felony warrants or other indictments that are presented to him or her, felony indictments. And that oath of office is very important because it confers to the Commonwealth's attorney his or her authority to bring cases and give voices of victims the voice that they deserve. And that is an important part of what we're trying to do in that office. And I'm very concerned that my opponent is embracing this political non-prosecution strategy. It's called progressive prosecutor, but it's better termed something like ideological non-prosecutor. Political choices are made in the General Assembly, not the top law enforcement officer in each jurisdiction. And when you undermine that principle, you're doing violence to the notion of equal justice under law, and you're undercutting public confidence in the fair administration of justice.
Is there a Republican way or a Democratic way of being a Commonwealth Attorney?
When it comes to enforcement priorities, there are sometimes differences, but those don't generally apply. In all cases, I'm running, and I would ask people to point to decisions or prosecution decisions I made that reflect a political orientation. Quite the contrary. It's a question of bringing cases that have been presented by felony warrant or direct indictment, seeking accountability, and faithfully supporting the law and Constitution. That's an important part of what we do. I was also asked about my position on ICE notification. The jail board, as you know, about a year ago asked whether the regional jail should be the first in the Commonwealth to stop notifying ICE before the release of non-citizens subject to criminal immigration detainer. I said yes, along with five of the other six law enforcement people who were consulted. It's important to public safety to ensure that criminal non-citizens who are identified for priority immigration review are at least held pending notification, or at least notification occurs more precisely before they're released. It's important to note for everyone to recognize our jail does not hold a single non-citizen beyond their state release date. The only question here is, does the jail continue to notify before that non-citizen subject to immigration detainer is released to give ICE agency possibility of coming to pick them up and placing them into custody? And we've seen in other jurisdictions like Montgomery, Maryland, where they haven't provided that justification and that notice, and you've seen the consequences of that.
You were elected first in 2015, running for your second term. What would you point to as perhaps your most significant accomplishment in those 4 years?
Establishment of a therapeutic docket for nonviolent offenders to get mental health treatment, not jail, expanding drug court, also bringing greater accountability for those who prey against our children and our elderly by creating this task force on elder abuse and exploitation, also enhancing child exploitation crimes, bringing the first commercial sex trafficking crimes in Albemarle history in this jurisdiction, and also cracking down on violent gangs like MS-13 that exist in our community. We've had 5 MS-13 convictions, and that's an important part of keeping our community safe. With accountability and comes deterrence, and with that deterrence comes the right of everyone to live without fear in their own community, giving voice to victims of crime, applying the law fairly but firmly. That's what we try to do on a daily basis.
Albemarle County is not Prince William. You're unlikely to be in office for 50 years. So, assuming that someday you are no longer Commonwealth's attorney, what have you learned on this job that you can bring to private practice?
I'm happy that I've received endorsements from people who are non-political. People like the former mayor of Charlottesville and current pastor at Mount Zion First African, Alvin Edwards. That's an important endorsement to me because it confirms the goal I had to be a non-political prosecutor. So working with people, daily recognition that we represent everyone, that policy trumps politics, and that we should also never forget that we have an obligation to give voice to victims of crime and serve our community while upholding the public trust and dignity of the office we're privileged to serve.
My last question is, you mentioned that the Commonwealth's attorney should not act on political impulses. That's the job of the General Assembly. If you were to lobby for some legislation, either to help the way your office operates or to change some criminal law, what would it be? What would you go to Richmond and say, we need this change in the law?
I think we can enhance funding for some of these non-punitive diversionary dockets. That would help. We could do a better job making sure that resources are there for people with mental health issues who present. You know, about a third of the people at our regional jail present with some sort of positive mental health screen. I'd also support additional resources to combat commercial sex trafficking. It is a problem that is endemic in our community, particularly in this area, and we've got to be forward-leaning and aggressive about it. I'm proud to have obtained 2 legislative accomplishments when I was up there. One is to enhance accountability for people who prey on the elderly. I'm working with David Descano to have a bill to make it easier for us to freeze accounts of elderly victims of abuse and exploitation before those funds could be depleted, and also working with Susan and John Graham and Chip Harding, who's endorsing me in this race, to expand the number of misdemeanor offenses for which DNA is collected post-conviction. And those are important safeguards to protect the elderly, also to make sure that those in jail who are innocent are given an opportunity to be exonerated, and also to hold people accountable for the crimes that they've committed.
Any final thoughts you want our listeners to know about?
I represent everyone in the community. I decided to run for this office because I love Albemarle County, and I want to continue to serve Albemarle County, and I will maintain the firewall between politics and the Office of Commonwealth's Attorney if I'm fortunate to be reelected.
Robert Tracy, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. We'll look forward to seeing the results on November 5th.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
Robert Tracy's Democratic opponent is Jim Hingeley. I talked to him about an hour later at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Jim Hingeley, you're a candidate for Commonwealth's Attorney in Albemarle County. You just stepped off the stage of a debate sponsored by the Senior Statesman of Virginia. What was your assessment of the debate?
Well, I thought it was a very good discussion, and I was happy to participate and grateful to the senior statesman for sponsoring this opportunity to talk about important issues.
Some of our listeners may be voting for the first time this year. They may not know what a Commonwealth's attorney is or what he does. In your words, what is a Commonwealth's attorney, and what's the role that you perform?
Well, the Commonwealth's attorney is a law enforcement officer. Commonwealth's attorney prosecutes cases that come into the office. They come in from various sources, mainly the police. So people who are looking to decide who to vote for need to consider that the Commonwealth's attorney represents the community and needs to do a good job. So in looking at the candidates this year for Commonwealth's attorney, there's a big experience difference between me and my opponent. I have 43 years experience as a lawyer. I taught criminal law for 20 years at the University of Virginia Law School. I started the public defender office in Albemarle County and served as the head of the office for 18 years. So I have what it takes in terms of experience and skills to do the job.
The election is a partisan one. Is there a Republican way or a Democratic way of being a Commonwealth attorney?
There is not a Republican way or Democrat way. There is, but we run as members of a party, and the parties that we run along with that label have certain values that they share. And I think that the Democratic Party, which I'm running as a Democrat, is looking at criminal justice reform as a priority. Republican Party is not so much, at least at the state level.
And how does a Commonwealth attorney exercise discretion in choosing how to prosecute cases?
Well, that's a very important question, and the premise is that the prosecutor uses discretion. And that means that of all the cases that are presented, the prosecutor has the responsibility to look at those cases and decide how best to prosecute them to achieve a just outcome. And so the prosecutor can choose, for example, not to prosecute a case, or to reduce a charge so that somebody can qualify for a special program. Or to prosecute a case to the maximum extent because that's what the circumstances warrant. But the prosecutor has all this discretion that everyday decisions have to be made by a prosecutor. And so that's why this election is important, because I've laid out how I would exercise my discretion. And I would do it in a way that I think benefits the community, and that's for the voters to decide.
The Commonwealth's attorney is a state official. The salary of the Commonwealth's attorney as a person is paid by the state, but the budget for your office is mostly provided by the county government. Is that correct?
I think it's substantially correct, although the State Compensation Board pays a substantial portion of the salary of the people who work in the prosecutor's office. Now, as far as the other expenses, the overhead expenses, the office expenses, those sorts of things, I think they're primarily paid for by the county. But there certainly is a mix of funding, and I would say that the state provides a significant or substantial part of the overall funding.
My reason for asking that is because I'd like to know what your approach would be in relating to other government officials, the Board of Supervisors, the sheriff, the others who are involved in government decision-making and especially law enforcement.
Well, since your question was about funding originally, I think the relationship between the prosecutor and the Board of Supervisors, who provide a lot of the funding, is an important relationship. And I have no reason to think that I would not be able to work cooperatively and effectively with the members of the Board of Supervisors to oversee the operations of the office from a financial standpoint. And by the way, all six current members of the Board of Supervisors have endorsed me in this race.
Moving up one level, going to the General Assembly, what kind of changes in law would you lobby for as a Commonwealth attorney to say, this is important for my office, or this is important for criminal justice, or this is just important for the community, and I'd like the law to be changed X, Y, Z?
Well, the first one is one that was just mentioned in a debate here at the Senior Statesman among Senate candidates, and that is I would advocate for the legalization of marijuana. And as was pointed out in this debate just now, we have a large amount of money that is spent arresting and prosecuting and processing people through the court system for possession of small amounts of marijuana, which I think the majority of Virginians believe should not be a criminal offense. So that's a big one to start with. Another one that I'm very concerned about is the fact that if you have a driver's license, or if you're unable to pay your court costs, you lose your driver's license. Now, Rob Bell in the legislature, on a small committee, managed to kill that bill when it came through this year, the bill to change that, the bill to stop suspending your license because you're too poor to pay your court costs. Nonetheless, Governor Northam kind of came around and put that into the budget, so we do have the right law in place now, but it's only in place until June 30th of 2020. So the next session of the legislature needs to take action to stop suspending people's driver's license when they're unable to pay their court costs.
You mentioned your 43 years of experience. Is there a particular case or client that you've worked for that you can point to as an unusual accomplishment, something that you're really proud of and that it would be your epitaph?
Yes, I can point to the fact that I've represented four men who were charged with capital murder and could have received death sentences. Every single one of them did not receive a death sentence, and I'm very grateful for that. I will also add that every single one of them was African American, and that we know, that's of course a personal example that I have, but we know from studies that the death penalty system is administered in a racially discriminatory way. That's why I will not seek death sentences if I'm elected.
And just some final thoughts, anything we haven't discussed here that you think our listeners should know about?
Well, I think going back to my experience, you get competence with experience, and I do have skills. And my opponent has not demonstrated the kind of competence that we need in our prosecutor's office. The example that we hear about a lot, and is a good example, is the Jason Kessler case. He prosecuted Jason Kessler, who was one of the white supremacists who organized the rally that happened here in our community in August of 2017. And Mr. Tracy lost that prosecution because he made a rookie mistake. He failed to prove that the offense of perjury occurred in Albemarle County, which is a simple matter to prove. Where was the magistrate's office where the full statement was given? Takes one question, and yet he couldn't even ask that one question. And so that victim, the person who was the victim of the false statement, did not get justice, and the community did not get justice.
Well, Jim Hingeley, thank you for your time today. I appreciate you being here at the Senior Center, and I look forward to seeing the results on November 5th.
All right. Well, thanks for letting us get together.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
The Senior Statesman of Virginia also hosted a discussion featuring three candidates for the Virginia State Senate. Two are looking to represent the 25th District, incumbent Democrat Cree Deeves and independent challenger Elliot Harding. Both of them have been recent guests on The Score. You can hear their interviews by visiting our website at bearingdrift.com. The other candidate was Amy Laufer, who is challenging incumbent Republican Bryce Reeves in the 17th State Senate District. Reeves was invited to participate in the forum, but declined the invitation. I spoke briefly with Laufer after the debate. Amy Laufer, welcome back to The Score from Bearing Drift. You just stepped off the stage of a debate sponsored by the Senior Statesman of Virginia. Your opponent was not present, but you got to interact with candidates from another district. What was your assessment of the discussion?
Well, actually, this I would say is I think my fifth one at this point, and a lot of other legislative forums. it's really interesting, just because the district is pretty big, the different conversations that we're having throughout the district. So, you know, it was just a bit different than the other questions we've had from other places.
Yeah, you mentioned that this district, the 17th Senate District, stretches from Albemarle to Fredericksburg and with a number of other counties in between. That covers a lot of territory, and how do you, what kind of different questions are you getting from people as you knock on doors or attend forums? That, something that you would hear in Fredericksburg that you wouldn't hear here in Albemarle.
Well, actually, I can say overall, the number one thing I hear at the doors is healthcare. People are afraid that they're going to lose their insurance. They're afraid of the rising cost of pharmaceuticals and just having access to affordable, quality health care. And the other thing about the district in general is that it's grown very quickly. And almost every single school division in the district is looking at capacity issues for their schools. And, you know, that's causing its own kind of issues in terms of, you know, capacity.
One of the questions that came up in the debate today was about energy and the environment, particularly renewable energy. This question that I have in mind was not addressed, but what do you think about getting offshore wind turbines on the Virginia coast? That doesn't really relate to people in Albemarle County,
right,
but it's a statewide issue that you will probably have to face in the General Assembly.
I know. I think there are actually, if I'm remembering correctly, I think I saw that in the paper a couple of days ago with the governor looking at that. You know, I think that's another option, and I think we need to be open to that because we do know that that is the future. We know that that grows the economy. Those are high-skilled, high-paying jobs. And eventually, it'll be cleaner for all of us to breathe. So I think we have to be open to that discussion.
You mentioned that homeowners are unable to sell their excess solar energy back onto the grid, whether it's Dominion or another company. What about solar energy farms? It's a strange situation where environmentalists are fighting against environmentalists.
So
what's your position on, say, a big solar farm in Culpeper County or something
like that? So just to let you know, there are several across the district, Spotsylvania, Culpeper. They go through the zoning process of the locality to, you know, to the local governments, and they all have been approved. So they've been, you know, they're in the process right now of creating these solar farms. But what I can tell you is if we want to get to a third of our energy being from renewable sources by 2030, which I think we should do, we have to allow homeowners to sell back their energy. Because we know a distributed model, that's a distributed model where many people are creating energy and not just these mega farms. You know, that it's really important that we allow homeowners to do that and business owners, because we know that is the way to get to a third renewable energy.
I want to switch gears a little bit and just talk about politics or philosophy. This is a question I used to ask people all the time, and I haven't recently, but this is a good opportunity. Is there a person in politics today who you disagree with on most of the issues, but you admire or respect otherwise? Because I bring that up because Senator Deeds mentioned how he has worked across the aisle with Rob Bell and,
yes,
and others.
Yeah.
I
don't think any party has a lock on good ideas. I really don't. And I really think what is happening right now is that we're blocking each other just based on Democrat or Republican. And we need to stop doing that. You know, I can just say on the school board, you know, actually, a 12-year-old came and told me an idea, and then I said, that's a great idea, and we actually ended up doing that. So we have to be open to ideas from everybody, and I absolutely feel that that is what I want to do. There's certain things that I know I really want to be persistent on, but overall, I think that's the way to better policy, quite frankly, is listening to everyone.
Yeah, well, I think that's about all for today, but I appreciate your time for a second time joining us, and thank you for being on The Score from Bering Drift.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
This week's interview from the archives features Jason Grumet, founder of the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. I spoke to him at the 2014 Virginia Festival of the Book in Charlottesville. His topic was civility and cooperation in politics.
So I'm Jason Drumet. I'm the president of the Bipartisan Policy Center. My book is called City of Rivals, Restoring the Glorious Mess of American Democracy.
Good title. Tell me about the Bipartisan Policy Center.
So I founded the Bipartisan Policy Center about 8 years ago with the help of four former Senate Majority Leaders, Tom Daschle, Bob Dole, George Mitchell, and Howard Baker. And we now have about 90 staff who are committed to the art of principled compromise and constructive collision of good ideas. We don't believe in nonpartisanship. We want people who are proud, aggressive partisans who are willing to substantiate their views and negotiate.
In your remarks earlier, you talked about media, money, and mandering of the
Jerry nature.
Tell me about those three things. What are they doing to bipartisanship in Washington?
So all three are significant issues in our democracy. My point is that they do not lend themselves towards solutions. So the somewhat myopic focus on the three of those as the reform agenda is going to make people frustrated. We've always had money in politics. We have more now. It's more transparent now. It could be more transparent still. But we have a Supreme Court that has made pretty clear that we're not going to be moving money out of politics anytime soon. And so I think a better agenda would be to try to force all donations to be disclosed. The media has always been confrontational. It's different now. It's disaggregated now. But it's not a new concept that media seeks out the conflict in stories. But again, the larger issue is the media gives us what we ask for, and there's no act in a nation with free speech that's going to change that. So it's a howling at the moon problem. Gerrymandering is a concern. It is undermining to the democracy to have the politicians choosing the voters as opposed to the voters choosing the politicians. It just doesn't matter as much as a lot of people think. The high watermark for redistricting reform would be the tenor of the U.S. Senate. There are no districts in the Senate. It is not exactly a venue of great collaboration. We have essentially sorted ourselves so that no matter how you draw districts, we are still going to have a diminishing number of competitive primaries. So I believe we need to make efforts to create bipartisan redistricting commissions and get away from some of these crazy gerrymandered districts. But in and of itself, it is not going to be the solution to the fractious nature of our democracy.
The Supreme Court right now is considering a case regarding a redistricting commission in Arizona. Do you know anything about that case and what the outcome might be?
Well, if I could tell you the outcome of that case, I could also tell you the price of oil in a month. An interesting question, because the essence of it, as I understand it, is that the legislature was basically taken out of the redesign process. It's an independent commission, and there is a question about whether, in fact, it is constitutional to have redistricting happen without legislative prerogative. It doesn't mean that you couldn't have redistricting commissions that require there to be three Democrats and three Republicans. I mean, you could do a lot. It wouldn't eliminate the capacity to seek better efforts when it comes to redrawing lines, but it could limit a certain type of redistricting commission.
Ethics reform has been a big issue in Virginia this year, and you talked a bit about that in terms of ethics issues in Washington. Can you just illustrate some of the problems with ethics rules?
Well, so the issue is simply that they're not perfect. They are over aggressive in certain areas in ways that I think make people feel better but don't accomplish much, and they miss aspects of the problem in other regards. And so I think the issue is really just to focus them more effectively.
One last question.
Yeah.
Yesterday, the president broached the idea of compulsory voting. How would that fit into your program, if at all?
Well, again, I think there is a constitutional issue. It's more of an aspiration than a practical solution. Like everything, there are pros and cons. Obviously, it would be terrific to have greater participation in a participatory democracy. In Australia, they find, though, the downside is a lot of people are essentially forced to vote who have no desire to participate in the process, no information about the process, and so there's a question about whether you dilute the quality of the voter pool. Having 20% participate is no good. Having 100% participate probably also has some problems. 60-70% would be great.
Well, thanks for your time today. That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. Tell your friends where to find us and join the conversation in the comments section on BearingDrift.com. We'll be looking for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bearing Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BearingDrift.com.